The NHL season is officially over and the NBA season is about to be, but football and baseball are getting just more exciting. The SEC made its triumphant debut last weekend. The NFL is starting to divide into its contenders and pretenders, and we finally saw our first big in-conference upset of the college football season when Kansas State came back and knocked off Spencer Rattler and the Oklahoma Sooners. How does OU's loss shake up the college football playoff picture? Just how bad is LSU? And can Mike Leach's offense survive long term in the SEC? Find out on this episode of Stone Cold Sports Talk.
Gives it to Jenkins for the championship. Auburn's gonna win the football game.
Fires to the end zone. Touchdown!
Jay Taft, good to be back with both of you all after a crazy weekend in college football and a less crazy but still an interesting weekend in the NFL. Let's just hop right into it. What were your takeaways from Saturday afternoon, Saturday night, about how college football has changed and what did you see last weekend that was kind of surprising to you maybe?
Yeah, Stone, I saw Oklahoma lose. Actually, you and I watched both of these games together. We saw Oklahoma lose to Kansas State, and we saw Texas Tech. I don't know how they did it, but they blew a, I believe it was a 15-14 point lead with 5 minutes to go against Texas. And that really, that Oklahoma game proved to me that this is the most wide open the Big 12 has been since 2013, when we had 1-8-1 team and then 3-7-2 teams right behind them. So this year, Oklahoma's definitely the most talented, maybe, especially offensively, but they've got an inexperienced quarterback, a suspect defense, and that combination is really what made them lose on Saturday. Kansas State had no business winning that game because I was just still perplexed at how Oklahoma lost this game, because you look at it, the number of first downs that each team had. Oklahoma had 28 first downs. Kansas State had 10, period, in the entire game. 28 and to 10. That's 18 differential. In the total yards department, OU had 517. Kansas State only had 400. Well, 400 is pretty good, but compared to 517, that's a pretty big difference. On third down, most staggering stat, on third down, OU was 7 of 12. Kansas State was 2 of 11. 2 of 11. That does not normally win you a football game. But the difference in the game, as is in about 90-95% of football games, was the turnover margin. And it was ugly. Kansas State was plus 4 in the turnover department in this one game on Saturday. And they outscored Oklahoma 17-0 in the fourth quarter. That was... the wheels fell off the boomer schooner more than they have in a long time.
Sooner schooner, Norman. Not boomer
the sooner schooner.
Schooner.
Yes, the sooner schooner, like it did last year when it tipped over. Not quite that bad, but the wheels just fell off this time. And then moving to the Texas game, they barely beat Texas Tech in what just screams Big 12 football to me. It was 63-56. There were over 900 yards of total offense combined between the two teams. And Texas was pretty bad on third down, too. They were 5 of 16, but they had really good offensive balance, which is what you really love to see. They ran for 214 yards, threw for 264, so just a 50-yard difference there. And Texas Tech, they can score with anybody, as we know, but they just cannot close for some reason. And so I'm not going to eliminate them from the Big 12 race, but they've certainly – they cannot have another buckle like they did against Texas if they want to find themselves at the top of the conference. And then Oklahoma State is still undefeated.
The boomer schooner, and I don't want to let this joke go too far without having a chance to say it. The boomer schooner, I believe, is a Viking river cruise from Prague to whatever is up the river from Prague, because that's what old people go on all the time. And I didn't look it up. A schooner is a boat, not the wagon. Don't know why it's called the Sooner Schooner, and it's a wagon, not some sort of small ship. Taft, what was your biggest takeaway from last weekend?
Well, Jay mentioned the two upsets the upset and the near upset in the Big 12 this past weekend, and then Oklahoma State falling 2 weeks ago, like you mentioned. And those were just three of many either upsets or near upsets that we've witnessed in the first 4 weeks of college football. And I think that we are in for a very, very interesting college football season. I think a lot of top teams are going to lose just because they had less time to prepare. It's a weirder year. It allows for more teams that usually wouldn't have a chance against these big schools to maybe pull off the upset. And we've seen that already, especially in the Big 12. So my takeaway from last week and just the first 4 weeks of college football in general are the amount of upsets that we've seen and that we should get ready to see in the coming weeks. And I'm very excited because who doesn't love a good upset? That's what makes March Madness so great. So we'll see what happens. We could see some this weekend, but I'm very interested to see how this odd season is going to play with upsets and with what teams could end up beating teams that they usually would not have a chance to beat.
I mean, maybe with all these upsets, we should adopt the ACC basketball method of tournamenting, and instead of having a four-team playoff, have it be, let's just go 64 whole FBS, rank them one through 16, divide it into four regions. Everyone plays everyone. You get, I guess, six. Yeah, just like the NCAA tournament, you have six wins to win a national championship. It'll get these teams to up to 15 games-ish, which they're used to playing if they win a natty. So, yeah, I mean, who wouldn't want to watch Clemson against, like, Vanderbilt? Or Vanderbilt's probably not even top 64 anymore. But I digress, in the words of Stephen A. Smith. My takeaway from last weekend watching the two games I spent the most time watching were Florida Ole Miss on Saturday afternoon when that was over, caught the tail end of the Oklahoma-Kansas State game. I'm glad I watched Florida Ole Miss, though, because I think there are a lot of telling signs about that team, which, first of all, offensively looks like a national championship contender already. Kyle Trask was unbelievable. So here's the good, the bad, and the ugly from that game for Florida. Kyle Trask and Kyle Pitts, the two Kyles. Just absolutely went off. Trask had six touchdowns. Pitts had eight catches, 170 yards, and four touchdowns. Looks like the best tight end in the country. Jay and I were talking before we recorded here today. He should be a top 10 pick in next year's draft. Damian Pierce and Malik Davis, the two-headed monster at running back, nicely filled in for LaMichael Perine, who was the feature back for Florida last year, combined for 16 carries for just over 100 yards. On the defensive side, Ventrell Miller looked awesome for Florida, had 15 tackles, 13 solo. And then Brenton Cox, a transfer from Georgia, already making his presence felt on the defensive line. He and Miller both had one sack each. And I believe that Miller was in on a play that he deflected the ball coming out of Matt Corral's hands. And then it fell to Brenton Cox. It was either one of them had the deflection, the other had the interception and forced a big turnover. Now, the bad for Florida, just like it was in big games last year, was the defense. Matt Corral just carved this defense apart, 22 for 31 for 395 yards. Elijah Moore, Jay, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he was the guy who did the dog peeing in the end zone celebration that cost Ole Miss the game last year. Is that correct?
I believe so.
He had 10 catches for 227 yards. I believe Ole Miss had 18.5 yards per reception, which is pretty bad for a defense that Florida likes to call DBU because, I don't know, C.J. Henderson was good for a season and Vernon Hargraves was also there. I'm not really sure what the foundation of that claim is, but it's something that Florida's defense erroneously makes every single year. But they looked bad on defense. All of the Lane Kiffin gadget stuff on the first two or three series was throwing Florida for a loop. And we'll get to a little bit of Ole Miss later. I have them in one of my bets of the week for this weekend. But they were just confusing that Florida defense. Sean Davis got ejected for targeting on the first possession of the game. And because of that, the secondary, I think Brad Stewart was not available. They had a freshman filling in at safety, did not look good. And the ugly, the bad wasn't even the ugly. Elijah Moore having 10 for 227 wasn't even the ugly for Florida. The ugly for Florida is allowing Ole Miss to go 9 for 14 on third downs, allowing 13.4 yards per passing attempt. So 18 yards of completion, 13.4 yards per passing attempt. And 613 total yards allowed. And I am kind of somewhat in camp fire Grantham right now. Todd Grantham on the defensive side of the ball did not look good for Florida at any point. The play calling looked just as suspect on third down as it did last year. And the Gators really seem to be struggling there. So that was my big takeaway, is that if Florida's defense doesn't improve, it doesn't matter. They're still going to lose to Georgia, and Todd Grantham will still be extraordinarily fireable. We're going to move on to our next segment now, Games of the Week. Taft, as you can tell, Jay and I left you deference in this category for what the only top 10 matchup of this week is, but it involves.
Yeah. We left you the bone, the best bone in the bag. So go ahead and take this one.
Is the best bone in the bag an expression?
Georgia Bulldogs hosting.
Okay. Go ahead.
Number 7 Auburn Tigers. Yes, Jay, the good old dog bone for my Georgia Bulldogs as they are hosting number 7 Auburn this Saturday at 7:30. It's a very exciting week in Athens, and it's very exciting for me as well, as I was fortunate enough to get a ticket through the student lottery. They're only giving away 3,500 tickets to each student, so somehow, some way, I was the lucky freshman who got one of those for what is going to be one of the most exciting games of the season for Georgia and really in the SEC, because it's going to have a lot of impact on the college football playoff down the road if these two teams live up to the hype that has been surrounding them this season. And it's also a big game for Georgia's it's going to be a very telling game, because we saw last week in the Arkansas game, Georgia's defense looked very solid, but the offense was pretty shaky. They only scored 5 points in the first, or excuse me, 3 points in the first half. Offensively, that was a field goal. Their other 2 points came from safety, which shouldn't surprise you if you're a Georgia fan, because you know that every year the defense, or recently at least, the defense has been superior to the offense. And Bulldog fans were a little hopeful this year that the offense would look a little better and more sharp with their new offensive coordinator in Todd Monken, but it didn't really look so last week. So there's a lot of questions to be answered on the offensive end for the Bulldogs, and the main one is the quarterback. We had our boy DeJuan Mathis start on this past Saturday, and he was atrocious, as Jay would say. He didn't look great. He couldn't score against the mediocre Arkansas defense, but thankfully the junior quarterback Stetson Bennett came to the rescue, saved the day, scored 22 points in the third quarter en route to a 37-10 victory at Arkansas. But Stetson Bennett isn't the clear starter for Saturday, because the USC transfer JT Daniels just got medically cleared, so it's going to be interesting to see who gets the start there. Speculation says it's going to be Daniels, just because he has a lot more talent than Stetson Bennett, but it'll be interesting to see what happens there. You can always count on the Georgia defense, so that's going to leave a lot of wiggle room for Bo Nix to prove himself as an elite SEC quarterback. The second year had an impressive outing week one against Kentucky, throwing for 233 yards and 3 touchdowns, but this is really going to be his moment to shine in the spotlight, so it'll be interesting to see this game. I'm very excited for it. Obviously as a Georgia student, but it should be a great game to watch. My prediction is going to be Georgia slightly winning in a low scoring game. So I'm going to go with 20-17, and I'd be very happy if that was the result. But for some reason, the line is Georgia -6.5. I don't think Vegas watched Georgia's game last week, but I would take a 3-point victory any day.
First of all, can we get these world's smallest violin for Felipe Franks and the official end of his career? I mean, I know he's going to start at Arkansas the rest of the season, but that was just – I want to say I felt bad, but after all that he put Florida fans through, I didn't really feel bad about his team being up at halftime and then choking against Georgia.
So his team hung around, though. That was the – you and I were watching that game together. That was a surprising first half.
I know it was a surprising first half. As with all surprising first halves from Felipe Franks, you get this half where you're like, maybe he really has turned the corner. Maybe this is time. Maybe I've been wrong for all these weeks. And then the second half ensues, and we get to where we are. Just want to throw two names into Taft's good analysis there. Seth Williams and Eli Stove, two very good targets for Bo Nix, had a great weekend against Kentucky last weekend. Jay, let's get to you. Your game is kind of off the beaten path, so explain why you think this one is your game of the week.
It is a little off the beaten path. I knew Taft was going to take his current school, Georgia, against Auburn. I knew you're an SEC guy. So I looked around, ACC, Clemson, UVA, UVA is going to lose by 35, 42 maybe. So I looked to the good old Power Six Conference, the American Athletic Conference, and I found the game that doesn't have the high rankings, of an Auburn-Georgia game, but it's certainly going to have the competitive nature. Number 25, Memphis, plays at SMU. Memphis, last year, won the conference, but SMU has Shane Buechel back at quarterback. So Memphis last week, in their only game of the season so far, defeated Arkansas State 37-24. They've got a wide receiver named DeMonte Coxie. Could very easily go in the first three rounds of the draft. He's their best offensive talent. And on the defensive side, linebacker Xavier Cullens ranks second on the team in tackles and first in sacks. So certainly keep an eye out for him. And then for SMU, they've played three games so far this year, won all three against Stephen F. Austin, North Texas, and Texas State. They've got, as I mentioned earlier, Shane Buechel and a stud linebacker named Delano Robinson, expecting to make a lot of plays on defense. So this game certainly does not have a top 10 matchup, not even a ranked matchup. But it's got. Remember a couple years ago, Stone, where South Florida played UCF?
Oh, the war on I-4. Oh, my gosh.
In the war for I-4, and it came down to the wire.
There was a kickoff return involved, right?
Yes, there was a kickoff return involved. UCF pulled it out, but it was still really close. I'm not saying this game will be like that, but I am saying that it's going to be close. I do have Memphis winning 35-31. But I would not be surprised if SMU finally got over the hump before superstar freshman Preston Stone comes in next year. Everybody's thinking the future for SMU these days. But I would not be surprised if SMU won. I am going to take Memphis, but SMU could certainly pull the upset here.
I love Shane, guys like Shane Buechel, who transferred from Texas, because I think that those storylines are always fascinating to watch. My game of the week is number 13, Texas A&M, at number 2, Alabama. A&M's last game, they surprisingly won a squeaker against Vanderbilt, 17-12. Somewhat,
that game was ugly.
Yeah, I would call that pretty humiliating for Vanderbilt, for Texas A&M. That's basically a win for Vanderbilt. That should count as a win for bowl eligibility. So maybe that gets them in Belk Bowl territory at this point. The Belk Bowl's dead. I think I forgot about that. That's sad.
No longer the Belk Bowl.
It's not the Belk. Is Belk no longer the sponsor, or is they're no longer a game in Charlotte?
No, there's still a game. It is now the Duke's Mayo Bowl.
The Mayonnaise Bowl in Charlotte, yes.
Yeah, but Duke Mayonnaise is really good, so I'll give it that. And they're not even paying for advertisement. I won't give Duke's Mayonnaise free advertising. I don't know if that's a violation of the FCC regulations or anything, but I don't think they listen to our podcast, thankfully enough. So we're going to keep rolling.
I just don't know what players are going to get, because usually you'll get stuff from the sponsor. They're just going to get a ton of mayonnaise.
A lot of different condiments. They're going to be all of their food is going to be very well condimented for like a year.
They're going to get so much mayonnaise, they're going to find a way to make mayonnaise an instrument and fulfill Patrick Starr's dreams.
Well, you know, I will say this. Duke's is kind of on the pricier side. It's like a more gourmet Hellman's. So I'm a big mayo guy. I would take going to the Duke's Mayonnaise Bowl and being able to get me a year supply of free mayonnaise, because it's a cut above. A lot of calories, not very calorie efficient. But anyway, Texas A&M's key players, Kellen Mond at quarterback. This feels like year 7 of Kellen Mond. I don't know what it is, but it feels like it's year 7. He'll be key to see if he can break down that Alabama defense. Isaiah Spiller at running back for Texas A&M. 8 carries, 117 yards last weekend. For a guy with 8 carries and 117 yards, I didn't watch the game, but it sounds like you might want to feed him a little more if he's running the ball that successfully. Bama key players, of course, Mac Jones and his I guess he finished out the season for Alabama last year, so it's definitely not his first career start, but relative much less experience than Tua had in last season, that's for sure. Najee Harris, the veteran running back at this point, and then all the receivers, Jalen Waddle and Devontae Smith being the leaders among them. My prediction is Alabama 38, Texas A&M 20. It's the game of the week because it's two top 15 teams, but with how A&M looked last week, would not be surprised if Mac Jones were riding the bench and Bryce Young were getting some reps halfway through the third quarter. But yeah, A&M, Alabama, top 15 matchup. Watchable for sure, but probably not a great game.
Is this game more likely to be a three-point game or that 59-0 redo that when Alabama just absolutely boat raced Texas A&M? Is it more likely to be that big of an upset or a very close, like, down-to-the-wire game?
I think it's like 51-49, I would say, in favor of blowout. The thing with A&M is they've got Jimbo, but it's like they're not – you have to remember that in the early years of Jimbo at Florida State, he had it mostly figured out, but there was still like a piece or two missing before he really got it down to an exact science. And this is year three. They should be really good, but I don't think he's got the same recruiting foothold like he had at Florida State early on, just because he inherited a program from Kevin Sumlin that wasn't quite as strong as Bobby Bowden's basically perennial power Florida State was. They were still history there.
They were still reminiscing Johnny Manziel.
Yeah.
Still. Maybe still are. But certainly were a couple years ago.
I mean, at least I think they all still have the play of Johnny Manziel fumbling, recovering, and then throwing to the end zone in Tuscaloosa. And then also when he broke out of like four tackles and just lobbed it downfield to Mike Evans, who somehow got it. Like, I think all those highlights are still going through. And as long as that's happening, you're not going to be able to move on. All right, time to move toward bets of the week. Jay, you're leading us off. One spread, one money line, one over under, por favor.
My spread this week was pretty easy. This is just straight up disrespectful, okay? Oklahoma is only a 7-point favorite at Iowa State. Let me remind you here, okay? Louisiana Lafayette went into Ames, Iowa, and beat Iowa State just 2 weeks ago, okay? I get it, Oklahoma lost last week, but this is a little ridiculous here, okay? Oklahoma State should win by 21, 28 points in this game. Should. They should have won last week by that much. This week is different. You got a mad Oklahoma team. You got a mad Spencer Rattler. You got a really mad Lincoln Riley. And a team that realizes if they lose again, they're out of the playoffs. So I don't expect this team to lose for a very long time now. And Iowa State is just the first victim on the revenge tour. So the 7-point spread in the OU-Iowa State game is just extremely disrespectful. And I'm taking OU with all the points, just blowing Iowa State out. My money line, I've got TCU. I think they've got a shot in this game because Texas looked suspect last week. So I'm going to take TCU plus 225 over the number 9 Texas Longhorns. And then in my over-under for the week, had to dig a little bit for this one, but I think it's got a pretty good shot of happening. East Carolina plays Georgia State, and the over-under is 69.5. Let me remind you, ECU scored 14 points last week, okay? And Georgia State scored 31 against Louisiana Lafayette in overtime. So I'm taking way under the 69.5 total in ECU-Georgia State. So I think the OU spread – and the ECU Georgia State over under are extraordinarily likely to happen, and I would not be surprised with that TCU money line.
If you were to ask me before I looked at our rundown how many times or how many different people would be talking about the East Carolina Georgia State game this weekend, I would have set the over under at 0.5 and figured maybe Jay would talk about it just because of, like, you know, getting deep into the annals of college football. But apparently Taft also wants to talk about East Carolina, Georgia State, and one of his picks of the week. Taft, explain yourself.
Yes. So when I was looking for a spread this week, I couldn't find any top 25 matchups that I thought were easy money. I thought all the lines were pretty much about where I would put them. So obviously I went to a random game in a non-Power 5 slate game. So I'm also doing ECU at Georgia State. I have Georgia State -1. I think they're going to cover that spread. Like Jay said, East Carolina's not great. They only put up 14 points in their last game. So I have Georgia State -1. And then for my money line, this one's tough as well. But I'm going to pull it up here. I think that very random game here, but Missouri – I don't know. Tennessee did not look good against South Carolina this past week. And Missouri is plus 11.5. It's an upset watch because the SEC has had some strange games, like that Vandy game where Vandy almost beat A&M. So Missouri will be my money line pick. Not too confident on that, but just a chance. Kind of like my super dog if I was Lee Corso. And then my over-under, a lot more confident on this one. It's Clemson, UVA. I have the over at 55. UVA scored 38 points in their win last week against Duke. And Clemson has this guy named Trevor Lawrence, who is known as Touchdown Jesus. So I think 55 points is going to get far past in that game. So I'm going to take the over for that.
I agree. I'm very tempted to put the house on UVA plus 28.5 and call it my lock of the week. But I didn't want to do that. I do agree, though. Hammer the over in Clemson UVA. Taft and I have a bit of disagreement in our it's funny. His moneyline underdog pick is in contradiction of my spread lock pick. I think Tennessee minus 11.5 over Missouri is a lock. I wanted to do it because I know a little bit about Tennessee and a little bit less, but basically nothing about Missouri. Tennessee looked bad. Yes, they did. South Carolina did muff a punt on like the last meaningful play of the game with the chance to go down and I guess win it. But it was a winless jam offense.
That was too funny. I still cannot get over that.
Also, minor correction, Taft mentioned that the East Carolina-Georgia State game was not a major power conference game, but I think the Power Six. I don't know what the American wants us to pronounce it as, but I believe they would disagree with that. Anyway, spread lock, I say Tennessee minus 11.5 versus Missouri. It seems like an appetizing line. I don't know what Missouri is going to look like. I assume Tennessee will be better. Tennessee is still, I think, on a 7-game win streak dating back to last season, which is remarkable. So I think Tennessee minus 11.5 against Missouri. Jarrett Guarantano, Ty Chandler, get it figured out a little more and beat the Tigers by maybe 13 or 14. It won't be a blowout, but it won't be a blowout by like 20-point, 40-point orders of magnitude. But it'll be, I think, Tennessee relatively comfortably. My money line pick of the week, another superdog. We all kind of went with superdogs this week. I think Ole Miss plus 195 over Kentucky. I like it just because if Florida's defense was thrown for a loop by Lane Kiffin and all of the window dressing that was there and the two quarterback system and having John Rhys Plumlee literally line up at quarterback for some plays, I feel like they could have even more success against a Kentucky defense that I at least hope isn't as good as Florida's, because if it is, then Florida's got real problems trying to be the number three team in the country. So I think Ole Miss plus 195 over Kentucky is a really appetizing number, and I think I would not be surprised if Ole Miss won that game outright. Obviously, I picked them as a money line underdog. I think that they've got a really good chance to, I guess that'd be an upset of Kentucky, but Kentucky didn't really look that compelling against Auburn last week either. And then my over-under pick, I guess Taft's 20-17 can't really coexist with this, but I think Georgia-Auburn over 43 or 44 or 45, depending on what site you use if you are going to actually bet that game. I feel like Bo Nix is going to have the Seth Williams connection working pretty well, and if not him, then Eli Stove. Auburn's offense looked okay last week. Georgia proved they could turn it on in the second half. 43 just feels like a pretty low number to me, and again, if it ends up being 28-17 and you're over 43, you're over that. Or if it ends up being 27-23, you're over that. And I think that it's a touchdown or a field goal away from being comfortably over that 43-45 range that it's at right now. Obviously, that might move. So my picks of the week, Tennessee minus 11.5 versus Missouri, Ole Miss plus 195 over Kentucky, and Georgia-Auburn over 43 or 44 or 45, depending on what site you're looking at. Now, before we head into facts or fake news, it is time for our Blast from the Past sports thing of the week, brought to you by the Poulin Weed Eater Independence Bowl, 1990-1997. Jay, take it away.
So when you told me to do this, a couple of names came to mind, okay? I told you last week that Darren Thomas, the former Oregon quarterback, was going to be a possibility. You can throw in LaMichael James there.
We'll do that when the Pac-12 comes back. We'll have one of them.
We can do that when the Pac-12 comes back. But a major throwback for this week is a guy named Graham Harrell for Texas Tech. He was a quarterback from 2005 to 2008. He finished fourth in the 2008 Heisman Trophy voting. Listen to this, though, and Taft. In three full seasons as a starter in Lubbock under Mike Leach, he averaged 5,124 passing yards a season. In his final 3 years in college, that's what he averaged, okay? He threw 134 career touchdowns. That's about 45 a season. So you've got a guy throwing for just over 5,100 yards and 45 touchdowns every season he started all 12 games or all 13 games. His average passer rating in his final 3 years was 154.27. Think about these numbers here, okay? This dude was absolutely going off. If this dude had these numbers in today's college game, he'd win the Heisman easily. Blowout, landslide, like Joe Burrow style, okay? His career completion percentage, it was 69.8%. That includes his freshman year when he started six games. That is higher than Marcus Mariota, Tua Tagovailoa, Jameis Winston, Andrew Luck, and Sam Bradford, all had in college. Mariota obviously won a Heisman with Jameis Winston and Sam Bradford, okay? So this dude was completing passes all over the field, throwing for a gaudy amount of yards, 45 touchdowns a season. And in 2008, the year where they beat Texas on that Michael Crabtree play that's gone down to history, they averaged 44 points a game with head coach Mike Leach. Another more school stat-related topic here. There's a guy named Patrick Mahomes in the NFL right now, okay? You know that guy? He went to Texas Tech, okay? And so this guy, despite Patrick Mahomes going there and Mahomes, who is the most talented guy I've ever seen play the position, Graham Harrell has more career passing yards, career passing touchdowns, career pass attempts, career completions, career yards per game, career 300-yard passing games, and career 400-yard passing games. More than Patrick Mahomes. Okay, this dude was absolutely ridiculous. He's third all-time in college history for career touchdown passes and fourth for career passing yards. So just think about, imagine if this guy played in today's college football, he'd win the Heisman easily. Maybe not last season because Joe Burrow was just one season of maybe the most elite stat season we've ever seen. But this year, it wouldn't be close. Graham Harrell's my blast from the past because this dude absolutely tore up the Big 12 and represented the epitome of what the Big 12 represents of all offense and absolutely no defense.
The interesting thing about Graham Harrell is that after that, he went to play for the Saskatchewan Rough Riders for 2009, the Green Bay Packers from 2010 to 2012, was on the Jets practice squad in 2013, and now is the offensive coordinator for the University of Southern California Trojans. So, fun fact there. Was 2013 – that wasn't – no, never mind. Tebow wasn't – never mind. We're not gonna get into the Tebow conversation. Now, facts or fake news time. Facts or fake news number one, whichever one of you wants to take this first can. The Philadelphia Eagles will finish the season with 6 wins or fewer.
That is a straight fact, okay? Let's read through the Eagles schedule here, all right? They've already lost to the Washington football team and the Rams, and they tied the Bengals last week. Their upcoming schedule, listen to this. They're at San Francisco, L, at Pittsburgh, L, and Baltimore, L. 3 in a row, make that 0-5-1. Okay, then they've got a shot. They've got the New York Giants at home on Thursday Night Football. That's a shot, okay? Let's give them that win, just for the benefit of the doubt. So they're 1-5-1.
That's a very Thursday Night Football game.
Yes, it is. Dallas, L, 1-6-1. At New York again, okay? I'll give them 1-1 against the Giants. So 1-7, okay, you're shaking your head. We'll go 2-6-1 here. At Cleveland, L, 2-7-1. Seattle, L, 2-8-1. At Green Bay, L, 2-9-1. New Orleans, L, 2-10-1. At Arizona, L, 2-11-1. At Dallas, L, 2-12-1. Washington football team, I'll give them a dub. 3-12-1. That's your Eagles schedule. They have no shot to get those 6 wins. We gave them the benefit of the doubt with that second Giants game, and they still only have 3 wins on the season. There's no way in the world they reach 6 games.
That schedule is just a giant L. Just one collective L. There's no winnable games. There's no layups.
They get Cleveland, Seattle, Green Bay, New Orleans, Arizona, Dallas, back to back to back to back to back. That's brutal. There's no way they get to 6 wins.
Taff, now that we have the entire schedule read aloud, agree or disagree?
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Jay. Even in the easiest conference in football, the NFC East, I think the Eagles will fail to get to 6 wins, especially after not even being able to beat the Bengals, who have probably the worst offensive line, than possibly Joe Burrow had at LSU last year. You could argue that, but point is, they should be the Bengals, and because they could not, I don't think they'll get 6 wins.
Yeah, I say facts on that too. Facts or fake news number two, Adam Gase will be fired as the Jets head coach by October 15th.
I'm going to give fact on this one. I think the Jets are just too bad, and they don't have much potential coming in. I mean, Sam Darnold has not shown great things this year, and I think that even though the Jets pretty much just clean slate, I think they won't have a problem doing it again and firing Adam Gase. And I think Adam Schefter would be on my side on this one, as he is a Jets fan, as he makes it clear during his Get Up show, but he's not a big fan of the direction the Jets have gone recently, especially this season.
I'm going to reverse course here. I'm going to call this fake news for one reason. They're going to give Le'Veon Bell a shot to come back and see what the team looks like healthy with their highest paid player back on the healthy roster. And I'll say this, he's expected to come back next week when they play Arizona. So make that October. Yeah, they'll play on October 11th. Okay, so that's the 4 days before your 15th deadline. I'm going to say fake news. I am going to say that they're going to fire Gase at some point this regular season, but they're at least going to give Le'Veon Bell a shot to come back on offense and see if he makes a difference. So October 15th is a little soon for me. I would set it probably mid-November. They're going to get to like 1-8, 0-9, probably 0-9, let's be honest here. And Gase will be gone. But the 15th is a little early for me.
I don't want to turn this podcast into a therapy session, but out of nowhere last night I had some weird dream, and it involved me reading on the ticker that Bill Belichick got fired, which totally beside the point. I don't know what frame of mind I was in that I had a dream Bill Belichick got fired. I'm gonna say Jay's argument was a good one. Taft's argument was also a good one. I'm gonna say facts though. Because I think if they get Le'Veon and Crowder back and they still get blown out by the Cardinals, I don't think it's crazy for them to blow it up early and try to get someone new in there. I think the earliest firing I can remember was Joe Philbin by the Miami Dolphins after a game in London in like 2015 or 16. I don't know what the Jets' patience is like on this, but I think, you know, we're in year three of Sam Darnold. This should be getting a lot better, and it's getting a lot worse. Well, so
I do agree, but think about who Sam Darnold has around him.
I'm not criticizing Sam Darnold at all. I think he's been put in an awful relationship with his head coach, and he has no weapons. Just an absolute losing situation for him. I think that's all the more reason why the Jets are going to fire Gase and try to get someone in there who can work with Darnold and at least try to salvage something from this season so he doesn't remain stagnant. Because if you're in year three and you're looking just like you did when you were a rookie, as either a problem with coaching or quarterbacking, and with Adam Gase and his track record as a head coach in the NFL between not really making Tannehill that much better and not really making Sam Darnold that much better, I think it makes him very, very fireable and fireable early on, especially given the results he had last season. And then this year supposed to be better with drafting an offensive lineman in the first round and getting Le'Veon back and healthy and Jamison Crowder getting better and Darnold in theory getting better. But if it just because they've plateaued so strongly and plateaued to being what looks like an 0-16 football team, I would not be stunned if they move on from it by October 15th. Having to pick a side, I will say facts. Facts or fake news, number three, the New York Jets / Giants will combine for 5 wins or fewer. That's along the same vein. Jay, I'm sure you have the schedules pulled up and ready, I hope.
Let me pull this up, okay? Let's look at this. The Jets first. Denver, L. Arizona, L. At the Chargers, this is a brutal stretch. At the Chargers, L. Buffalo, L. At Kansas City, L. New England, L. Back-to-back-to-back weeks, okay? At Miami, bye week, and then they get the Dolphins again at home. I'm not going to rule out that second Miami game, the one in New York after a bye week. So let's go ahead and give them that one. That'll be their one. That'll be, yeah, their one win of the season. Let's read the rest of their schedule. Okay, they got the Raiders at Seattle, at the Rams, Cleveland, and at New England. 1-15 at best for the Jets. Okay, so there's one win. The Giants. Oh, Lord. The Rams, L. Dallas, L. Washington, reasonable. Let's give them that one, okay? It's in New York. Let's give them that one, okay? At Philly, what did we say with Philadelphia earlier? That was an Eagles dub.
We had them getting swept by the Eagles.
Yeah, okay. So they've got a dub against Washington, at Philly, L. Tampa Bay on Monday night, L. Washington on the road, dub. So make that 2. Philly, dub. So that's 3. At Cincy, that's going to get interesting. We'll give them – okay. What do you think about that one? Giants at Bengals.
By that point in the season, I got Joey Burrow.
All right. And then the rest of – oh, good Lord. Listen to this. at Seattle, Arizona, Cleveland, at Baltimore, Dallas. Oh, my goodness. So what did we end up with?
The NFC East chose the worst season in NFL history to draw the AFC North as their, like, their divisional crossover games.
The AFC North and the NFC West. It's absolutely insane. So what did we end up with? 3 wins for the Giants and 1 for the Jets. So that's under your 4. So I'm gonna go the Giants will combine for 5 wins or fewer. I'm going to call that fact.
Taft, agree or disagree?
I'm 5 wins for 2 teams. That's just too low. I think that they'll manage. They'll figure out. Either team will figure out a way to get some wins that they maybe aren't favored to win. So I'm going to go. I think that the Jets and Giants will combine for 5 wins or more. So I'm going to say that is fake news.
I think it could be a push. I think it could very well be the case of a 4-12 and a 1-15, or a 3-12, a 3-13, and a 2-14. I'm going to say facts, though, just because it's exciting to think about New York sports fans getting a combined, like, 5 good Monday mornings coming out of their NFL Sundays.
5 out of 32.
Yeah, it's pretty sad. Facts or fake news number 4, the second to last, also known as penultimate, fun word. One of Florida's Kyles will be a Heisman finalist. Kyle Trask currently +700, trailing Derek King, Trevor Lawrence, Justin Fields, Sam Ellinger. Pitts is not on the most recent one I saw. Tight ends being Heisman finalists feels kind of weird, but with how Kyle Pitts has started, if he can keep it up in the SEC, probably get some consideration. One of Florida's Kyles will be a Heisman finalist. Jay Banzette, facts or fake news?
This is actually a lot tougher than I thought it would be. I'm tempted to say facts, but it's just something about the aura of Florida football. Kyle Trask is phenomenal. He has a much better shot than a tight end. Even Pitt could absolutely go off, and they're just not going to give a tight end a Heisman finalist. But I'm going to have to go fake news here. Let's think about it. Trevor Lawrence is essentially a guarantee, barring injury. Justin Fields is essentially a guarantee, barring injury. Ellinger / Rattler is going to be there. Derek King, if he plays well against Clemson next week, yeah, maybe. Sam Howell at Carolina, I don't know. So I'm really tempted to say facts here, but I got a gut feeling that goes against my brain saying that Kyle Trask will not make it. I think that Georgia game is really going to hurt him. He's going to struggle against Georgia, and that's going to end up costing him a trip to New York.
I was just going to say the same thing, just because I feel like with a guy like Kyle Trask, who wasn't supposed to be a trendy Heisman favorite, all that the voters want is one game to look at to disqualify him, and the Georgia game could very well be that one for him. Taft, what do you think? One of Florida's Kyles is a Heisman finalist, facts or fake news?
I think that is fake news. Kyle Pitts, he's a great tight end, but I just don't see him being a finalist for the Heisman Trophy. There have only been 2 tight ends to ever win the Heisman Trophy, and I don't think that Pitts will get the chance to be the 3rd. And then Kyle Trask, he's shown some great things, but really he doesn't have that much experience. He came in to replace Felipe Franks early last season, and he was great. He was a great replacement for Florida, and I think he's going to have a good season this year as well. However, I don't see him being a Heisman finalist. He's going to have to prove a lot in a very tough schedule with the conference-only SEC play, so I'm going to go fake news.
All right, and facts or fake news number 5. We're going to change this one a little bit. The Los Angeles Clippers will never have a higher winning percentage and or make it deeper into the playoffs with their next head coach. Now, for context, Doc Rivers has been the coach, or was the coach of the Clippers from 2013 until a couple of days ago. His first season, fun fact, he actually had the best winning percentage that he ever had. They went 57-25, were the number one seed in the Western Conference, and then lost in the conference semis to Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant in the Oklahoma City Thunder. After that, 56 wins, 53 wins, 51, 42, 48, and then 49 in the shortened season, but still a lower winning percentage at 68.1% as opposed to the 69.5% he had in his first season on the job in L.A. A couple of years left of that of the Kawhi Paul George experiment, maybe fewer than we think. Jay and Taft, do we think the Los Angeles Clippers will ever have a higher winning percentage and or make it deeper into the playoffs with their next head coach than they did during these 7 years of Doc Rivers?
I'm going to say that they will never have a winning percentage, a higher winning percentage. That is a fact. The coach is not the issue here. Doc Rivers is widely seen as one of the best coaches in the National Basketball Association. He just had a bunch of players that folded in games 5, 6, and 7 against the Nuggets. It's that simple. There's not much coaching you can do when Kawhi Leonard and Paul George combine for fewer than 25 points in game 7. I don't care who you are. Whenever your two best players combine for fewer than 25 points in the most important game of your season, that's not coaching. That is just players folding under pressure. So I think it was wrong for them to fire Doc Rivers. Because when you fire a coach, that means you think you can have somebody better for the job. And I'm not sure that there's going to be a guy available in the NBA who is better than Doc Rivers for the Clippers situation. So I'm going to say it is fact that the Clippers will never have a higher winning percentage or make it deeper in the playoffs with their current roster and a new coach.
Yeah, the Clippers loaded up this with Paul George and Kawhi Leonard, and they traded away a lot to get those two players and their supporting cast. I believe they gave away 7 draft picks over the next 7 years or something like that to have the roster that they have now. So basically they were just front loading for this season and maybe the next couple seasons. But I think it will take a little bit for the head coach to get his system going. And then once he does that, he just won't have the players or the talent to get anywhere near what Doc Rivers accomplished in LA. So I do not think the Clippers will have a higher winning percentage or make it deeper in the playoffs with their new head coach.
The Clippers and the Rockets both feel kind of similar to me in that both got rid of their head coaches because they're like, oh, well, this might be the problem. We haven't tried this yet, so let's throw this out there. But I think both of you are exactly right. I don't think the Clippers are going to be any measurably better with whoever their next head coach ends up being. The same way I don't think the Thunder and the Rockets are going to be measurably better with their head coaches. The Billy Donovan thing, especially this offseason, is an absolute head-scratcher. I don't know how you let someone like that walk, given the fact that he took a team that had a 1% chance of making the playoffs preseason into the playoffs and into a game 7 against the guy that he traded away, against Russell Westbrook, who he said, you know, this guy doesn't work with our system. We're going to give him away. And the Thunder were supposed to be tanking. They were supposed to be getting an early draft pick. But instead, what they got out of it was Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, 1,000 draft picks for allowing Westbrook to walk and or for getting rid of Westbrook. And I don't know why the Thunder moved on. I don't know why the Rockets moved on. I don't know why the Clippers moved on. It just doesn't really make that much sense for any of those teams. I am going to say facts. I don't see the Clippers getting any measurably better this season. Jay, I'm interested in your thoughts and Taft too on the Rockets-Thunder thing, getting rid of their head coaches. What do you think?
I thought both were ridiculous. I agree with you. As I just said a couple minutes ago, when you fire a coach, that means you believe there's somebody who can do the job better than the guy you just had doing it. And Billy Donovan took a team that had a 3% chance to make the playoffs and took them to game 7 of the first round against 2 former MVPs and the Houston Rockets. So I don't know what else you think maybe you think your roster is something that 99% of the United States thinks it's not. Maybe you think you can get to a conference final, but I don't really know what the expectation is in Oklahoma City. I'm not sure I want that job if the expectation is to take that roster any further than it got this year. So it's just for Oklahoma City, it's all about lowering expectations. And then, as I just said with the Clippers, it's not a coaching issue. It's a player issue. You've got players who folded under pressure. So I don't know where they're going to look to find people who were better for that job in each respective organization than the people that they just fired. I don't know where that's going to come from.
And the other thing is that Russell Westbrook, James Harden, Chris Paul, Kawhi Leonard, Paul George are all getting older. And in a Western Conference where you have a Denver team that was a surprise conference finals, made a surprise conference finals appearance that only seems to be getting better, when you have the Mavericks, you have the best young player in the league who's only getting better and took the Clippers to 6 games. And you have a Trailblazers team that is interesting when completely healthy at the very least. But mainly those two concerns with Denver and with Denver and Dallas. They're only going to be getting better. And how is the new head coach really going to account for having to guard Luka Doncic or having to shut down a guy like Jamal Murray or Nikola Jokic? It's a zero-sum game in the Western Conference right now, and I don't think any of those teams is going to do any better next season or the season after with whoever their next coach ends up being. So that is all we have for today on episode 19 of Stone Cold Sports Talk. Next week will be number 20, which will be exciting, a nice little milestone, even though it's been like 2 years and we should have done more. Thank you both for your time today. Thank you all, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to this one, Stone Cold Sports Talk episode 20. Have a great weekend. A lot of good college football on, mainly Auburn, Georgia. The other stuff is watchable. The Hoos might cover against Clemson, which would be exciting. Great college football weekend.
That's a big might, Stone.
I know it's a big might. I know it's a big might, but we can only keep hope. We're celebrating. UVA is going to celebrate like we won a national championship if we cover against Clemson. That's all we have for you today. Thank you for listening. We will see you next time. I'm glad we kept this a little more civil than a presidential debate and didn't talk over each other, and that's all we'll say on that. We'll see you next time.